me okay? Great. Yeah, you know what? Let's leave that up for a sec because I want to. I thought I would make a few comments about what Menachem said, and then talk about kind of applying new technology to think about life cycle consumption smoothing and planning. But I want, you know, Menachem kind of started the talk by saying that we have this review of work that's been done of late that doesn't include his paper. I think that's kind of a disgrace, really. This is one of the classic papers of all time. I can't imagine anybody writing about the subject without making this the first paper. You know, if I think about the classic articles that really influenced me intellectually as a graduate student and subsequently when I was, going through my early stages of my career, it would have been the Samuelson consumption loan model and the Yari model in terms of thinking about, and work, I guess, by Fisher, really. So these are the giants of life cycle economics, even. I know Franco Modigliani also clearly had some critical work there, but I wouldn't put it exactly in the same league, to tell you the truth. I think the real theoretical insights, and then there's, of course, Peter Diamond's work, and I guess Allais, which I never got to read because it was in French. But and I was kind of fascinated to know that this issue of how much of wealth is due to life cycle accumulation versus bequest was kind of at the heart of his early thinking about this topic and trying to understand why there is any wealth and why don't people just leave it. So in presenting a theory of annuities and explaining that people really should annuitize under certain circumstances, he's in effect saying there shouldn't really be anything but life cycle wealth accumulation. And that question seemed to me to be an important one in the early 80s when I was kind of somehow, that came up into my brain and other people's brains too. Tobin was looking at this in a simulation study that he did in the 70s, how much of wealth could be explained by the life cycle model in a steady state. Michael Darby did a paper on this, and then I did something with Larry Summers trying to understand this with some more extensive a data analysis to understand how much of wealth was really due to this hump saving. Was the hump big enough, in effect, to explain the total wealth to income ratio for the economy? And our finding was that it was far too little. And that raised, of course, the question of why was that? Were people altruistic? And as Ricardo raised the idea back in the 1820s, was it? The Ricardian equivalence. I mean, he kind of raised the idea of altruism and more or less rejected it. And then Robert Barrow had that famous paper that in 1974 that gave us a nice little working off of Becker's, I guess, kind of static kid-parent rotten kid theorem. It wasn't so clear exactly how that was being set up. But Barrow had a very clear picture of how you could get to intergenerational bequests and how you could turn individual finite horizon behavior into an infinite horizon model. And so that suggested, well, there's a lot of altruism out there, but the other possibility was that it's not altruism, but rather we have just an income, we have annuity markets that aren't working for some reason. We have people that aren't necessarily altruistic, but they're not annuitizing, and consequently they're leaving money to the next generation, not out of any desire, out of any altruism, but just because they don't fully annuitize. Or there's the possibility that they're making deals. You know, they're buying services of the kids from making these transfers to the kids. And of course, there's enforcement issues, and that's, I think, the prisoner's dilemma. I think that comes back to this prisoner's dilemma question. Can you actually, if you can't get the parent to swap you the money right now for taking care of him or her, then how do you enforce the contract if he hands over the money in his will to his girlfriend or, you know, boyfriend? And then there's also a possibility that these transfers, these contractual relationships between the parents and the kids don't rest on actual services, but rather just risk sharing, just with intra-family risk sharing. A parent and a kid who don't really like each other will still decide to share risk because contracting in the market is too expensive, there's transactions costs, there's information problems. The parent and the kids know each other, they know they both have common knowledge about their survival mortalities, and they make a deal. If you live longer than expected, I'll take care of you, and if you don't, you'll give me your money. And that deal could be somewhat enforced by going along the way, so that the parent doesn't wait till he's running out of money to turn to the kid and say, give me money. He could say, each year, look, I lived another year, give me some money. And notice you're still in my bequest. So, and the courts will help, I think, enforce these deals if support is provided along the way. So that led me to naturally question what's going on here. Is there any sign of altruism within the extended family, or is there even any sign of selfish risk sharing within this extended family? Because they both of those things have very strong implications. The altruism story says that the distribution of resources between the parent and the kids doesn't matter. If Moish and I are father and kid, and the government comes along and redistributes between us, or nature or luck does, and he ends up with more of the pot and I end up with less, then his consumption shouldn't change, and mine shouldn't change either. It's a one big happy extended family. Just shout. Not bad.
You might want to take the name tag off. I think that's what David's problem was.
Okay, I'll say, all right, sure. Good, good. Okay, thank you.